frequently the Bible will use words that have a physical connotation and make a spiritual application to them. For instance, the Bible would use the word heart, not in the sense in some context of the blood pump that we have and upon which our body depends, but rather it will, by metonymy, by figure, transfer that thought or that word to convey some thoughts about the innermost part of man. And I think there's a reason for that, because the heart itself, the physical heart of man, is that which is so vital to our existence. If the heart stops beating, we don't live very long. It is by that pump that the blood is circulated through our bodies and by which our bodies are kept alive. And if the blood does not circulate, then we have no means by which we can exist. And as a result of that, I'm sure that people have done a tremendous amount of research, that we have become very conscious of cholesterol levels, of heart diseases, of our diets, of trying to relieve stress. And there's been a lot of research in reference to bypass surgery that has become so commonplace today that it's almost like minor surgery. I use that in quotation marks. Certainly for someone who's had bypass surgery, it's not minor, but it's just something the doctors do all the time now. And we've advanced to the point in time where people can have heart transplants in order to live, and they perfected that to some degree. The person might live several years after his own heart has become diseased and could no longer function. So from that background, I think God appropriately took the word heart and used it to apply to the innermost part of man. It relates to man's emotions, to his thinking part, to his will part, and sometimes I use the word, I think appropriately so, consciousness. That there is inside of you and inside of me a consciousness of who and what we are. That part of us that is that consciousness thinks and feels and wills. And that differentiates us from animal life, from beasts that just simply exist and are programmed by God. By instinct, they perform things, and that's the way God made them. But we are conscious. And so that part of us, that's the inside part of us, is referred to by God as the heart. Can a man be what in reality he is not? And while you're contemplating that question, think about its significance. Can a man be in reality what he is not? And the answer is no. There is a facade that we frequently present to men in the way we appear to men, and men draw conclusions about what we are based upon that appearance. But that may not be what we really are. And what we really are is that which is in time manifest by our behavior. It slips out. It comes out, because that's what we really are. And there might be three responses to that question. A first response is a person says, well, I am what I am, and I can't change, and so I'm just going to live the way I am. And I'm going to be mean, and I'm going to be cruel, and I'm going to live in all kinds of licentiousness, because that's the way I am. That's what I am. I think that's a false response. We'll offer another alternative in just a moment. A second person views that question. He says, well, if I am what I am, in reality, that's what I am. Then I've tried as best I can to be good and to be different, and I've failed at that, and so I just give up. I just give up. I am what I am. I can't change that. Can't be any better. But I think the third response is the appropriate one that we shall pursue in the final course of this lesson. A man says, yes, I recognize what I am really like, what my heart is like. And I try to do better, and I fail sometimes. So what I'm going to try to do is to try harder, because with God's help, I can change what I'm like inside. I can change that part of me. And then I am in reality what I am, and not something different. With that in mind, let's turn our attention to the context that was read in your hearing this morning by Brother Doyle Nietzsche. From Mark, the 7th chapter, verse 1 down through verse 23. We're going to explore that context in detail because in that context, Jesus uses this appropriate figure and he makes some very good applications from it. As he addresses the people who have come to him and have made some charges against his disciples. And this all fits together as a unit. So we're going to look at it as a unit, progressing on through the scenario of the events and of Jesus' statement in response to what they say. Mark chapter 7, beginning in verse 1. Then the Pharisees and some of the scribes came together to him, having come from Jerusalem. Now, of course, that's the religious headquarters. These are the so-called authorities. Now, when they saw some of his disciples eat bread, with unwashed hands, they found fault. For the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they wash their hands in a special way, holding the tradition of the elders. Now, that particular way they did it is not known for sure. The literal expression, as I understand it, is the closing or the rubbing of the fist inside the palm. It was a meticulous way by which they were very careful that they followed that procedure by the tradition of the elders, and when they finished, then their hands were clean, and then and only then could they eat. It wasn't a matter of being free from germs. Now, that might have been a part of it, but the real idea was that here was a way in which they could be religiously clean and therefore receive their food. And if they did not follow that procedure, though they might have washed their hands, they would not have been pronounced cleansed by the Pharisees, by those who bound their traditions. And so in verse 4 it says, when they were come from the marketplace, they do eat unless they wash, and they are many other things which they have received, and hold like the washing of cups and pitchers and copper vessels and couches. Now again, it wasn't always for the purpose of cleanliness. That is, making them clean like the lady might wash her dishes, so that when you eat from them again, you're not eating from dirty dishes. But it was a ceremonial thing with them, and they had to follow this procedure in order that they might be cleansed appropriately. Then the Pharisees and scribes asked him, "Why do your disciples not walk according to the tradition of the elders, but eat bread with unwashed hands?" Now that's the thing that they latch on as they view Jesus and as they view his disciples. They didn't wash their hands. And it wasn't a matter they didn't wash them at all. But they didn't wash them based upon the tradition of the elders. Someone, and this was conveyed in Linsky's commentary, someone counted the number of commandments that they had in that period of time. Not just the law itself, but in conjunction with the law of their traditions. And there were 613 different commandments. Then they had seven others that they weren't for sure that belonged in there, and there was a debate about whether or not they should be or should not be. I think you can understand from this how this bore down so much on the people of the time and was really suppressive to them. It was indeed not just that the law was a burden, but that all these traditions of the elders were so burdensome to them. And they're very careful now about making sure that they follow everything exactly according to the tradition of the elders. Jesus answers them in verse 6 by saying, first of all, Isaiah prophesied of you. Now, he doesn't mean by this that when Isaiah spoke that he had in mind particularly these people. But as Isaiah spoke this, God was saying to the people of his time, hear what I say. This people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. Now that's the first observation. And in vain they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men. That's the second observation. He says, Isaiah was prophesying of you. And as what Isaiah said was appropriate to the people of that time, and they drew nigh to God with their lips, and they praised him and honored him, him with their lips and mouths. God says, your heart, now there's our word, your heart is far from me. Your bodies are here. Your hearts are somewhere else. And he says, your worship is vain. Second of all, because you teach as doctrines the commandments of men. Your heart's not here, though you present the verbalization. And then something else is taking place because they don't really respect God and they don't give to God heart worship and service. They begin to substitute their commandments for God's commandments. Now that's the first charge he makes against them. It's one thing to say that, it's another to prove it. Sometimes we may make an observation about a person and we may find fault with that person and we may charge that person with something and we say, all right, here's what you're guilty of. And you say, okay, if I'm guilty of that, where is your proof? It's one thing to charge it. It's another thing to substantiate the charge with some proof. So he conjoins with that idea. To illustrate it, he says, laying aside the commandment of God, you hold the tradition of men, the washing of pitchers and cups and many other such things you do. He said to them, all too well you reject the commandment of God that you may keep your tradition. Now here's how I'm going to substantiate the charge. Moses said, which in Matthew's account, God said, same thing. God spoke this, Moses recorded. God said, honor your father and your mother, and he who curses father or mother, let him be put to death. Now this is called the first commandment with promise, because the promise attached to it as they would go into the promised land of Palestine was that when you show reverence and respect for your parents, and that's not just as a small child, but as you grow older, and you requite your parents in their needs, you provide for them when they can't provide for themselves, that says that as long as you do that, it is well with you in the land. I will prosper you in your land. That's the attachment of that commandment. But he says, you say, verse 11, if a man says to his father or mother, whatever profit you may have received from me is carbon. Now, if my memory is correct, this is an Aramaic word. And it's a word that they would just pronounce. And in their traditional background, in their binding of their tradition, that when they said to this parent, parents come and they say, son, we are in need of help. We brought you into this life. We provided for you while you were young and you couldn't help yourself. We made a living and gave you all those things by which you were cared for adequately. Now we can't care for ourselves. We need your help. He says, carbon. And that just covered it all. You know what they meant by that? By using that word, which means a gift, the rationalization process followed like this. When you make a vow to God, that is a sacred vow, it takes precedence over everything else. So we're making a vow and saying this money that we ought to give to you is a gift that is dedicated to God. We vow it to God, and therefore we are excused from taking care of you. You go take care of yourself. This money is God's money. Very smooth process of rationalization. We do that sometimes. To get away from what God says, we just smoothly slide through a process and say, well, now if this is true, then that's true, and here's how it is, and this takes precedence over that, and so I'm excused from what God says. That's what they did. Carbon. And that covered that whole process. Jesus says, then you no longer, verse 12, let him do anything for his father or his mother. Here is the conclusion of that, making the word of God of no effect through your tradition which you have handed down, and many such things you do. That's just one thing. Now let's notice something first of all about that. When they do that, you see what he's saying is the substantiation to my charge against you. God says, you honor me with your lips, your heart is far from me. You take my commandments, you set them aside by your tradition. They say, prove it. He says, here's proof. God said this. Your traditions say this. And you've taken your traditions and put them in the place of God. And let me tell you something. When a man does that, he takes issue with the authority of God. It's not just one commandment. It's not that they didn't just like that commandment. But if they can set aside that commandment by their tradition, what commandment is sacred? None. Because what you've done is defy the very awesome authority of God. When God gives one commandment, it has equal authority to every other commandment. That's the reason that when you read James the second chapter, and James takes issue with the brethren there because they're showing respect to persons, and he says, you violate the royal law. He says, there's one lawgiver. And if you violate one law, you're guilty of all. And that means that you simply stand condemned as a lawbreaker because you've shown disrespect for the authority of the lawgiver. Now that substantiates the charge he has made against them. And it seems as though they either leave or he moves away from their presence and from that strong charge and proof of that charge. And he knows that he can't reach their hearts. Because Isaiah had appropriately said, your heart is far from me. He has met their charge. He has replied to them. But he's not reached their hearts because their hearts are far away. But now he draws the multitude. He draws the people to him and addresses them. In verse 14, he said to them, hear me, everyone, and understand. Now, these people weren't going to understand. But maybe he can reach the masses of the common people. Hear me and understand. He says, there is nothing that enters a man from outside which can defile him. But the things which come out of him, those are the things that defile a man. If any has ears to hear, let him hear. That's all he says. That's all he says. But that's such a profound truth that every one of these people, and the disciples as well, ought to grasp that concept. They should have known all along. What you eat doesn't defile the spirit part of you. It's not something that you take into your body and your body assimilates. That can't make you unclean. But, he says, it's what comes out of the man. Not what goes in that he eats and goes to the stomach and is cast off, but what comes out of the man, that is really out of the heart, the inside part of it. If you hear, you're attuned, you want to understand, then hear what I've got to say. Now we shift from that scene. You see, we've been where Jesus was talking directly to the Pharisees and their hypocrisy. They are removed from the scene, and now he addresses the people, hoping to reach their hearts. And he turns from that and enters into a house. In verse 17, away from the crowd, his disciples ask him concerning the parable. Now, it's strange that Luke or Mark, Matthew, refer to this as a parable. Normally, when we think of a parable, we think about things like the sower and the soil. Or we think about the kingdom parables that Christ taught, like the seed that's sown among the tares. It was an entire lesson then that was paralleled with the physical things in order to extract a spiritual truth. But he calls this a parable, and the disciples come to try to understand the parable. What is the parable? The statement Christ made. He is by an illustration of the physical part of us, comparing that to the spiritual part of us. And the observation he made about the material physical part is that we eat food, that food is assimilated, it's digested, it goes through our bodies, and is cast out. It doesn't defile us. But by comparison, the spiritual part of man is defiled not by the eating of food, but it's defiled by what comes out of the inside of man. Now, they say, explain this to us. Do you understand what Jesus has meant by this? Well, we say, we understand this. Why? Well, we've studied it before, perhaps. Or having the advantage of all this laid out for us in written form, we can compare it, unlike just Jesus saying this in the very brief form in which he said it and answering this to the crowd and then going on his way. Explain it to us. So he begins to clarify. Verse 18 he says, "Are you thus without understanding also? Do you not perceive that whatever enters a man from outside, that is outside his body, as he takes it inside his body, because it does not enter his heart," there's the second time this word appears, "but his stomach, and is eliminated, thus purifying all foods." That is, that foods were designed by God for the purpose and function of the body, that when a man eats food, he takes it into his body, but does it reach his heart? Does it reach the consciousness, the willing, the thinking, emotion part of man? It doesn't get there, because it just goes through his stomach, assimilated and used by his body, and then is cast out. And so it's all pure because it does not and cannot defile the man. Then in verse 21, "For from within," and that's identifiable with the heart that the food cannot touch, "out of the heart of men proceed evil thoughts, adulteries and fornications, murders, thefts, covetousness, wickedness, deceit, lewdness, an evil eye, blasphemy, pride, foolishness." Now Luke's list is somewhat longer than the other writers of the Gospels, but they cover it in briefer form. He's just a little more elaborate in what he says as he records Jesus' words. All these things, he says, come from within and defile a man. What I'm going to affirm to you this morning as we begin our study is that all of our problems in reference to our relationship with God, in reference with our relationship to our fellow man, are directly related to our hearts. Our hearts are our problems. And if we were like the physical world, not many of us would be alive. In other words, if we say, if the heart doesn't beat, the body dies. And you compare that to the spiritual part of us, and we say, if the heart is not good, the spirit dies. Well, we might be in bad shape. And if that is a true analysis, we need to spend a lot of time dealing with our heart problems. Because what comes out, what we say, what we do, where do those things come from? They come from the heart. The body cannot do, cannot say, cannot act in a way that's out of harmony with what's inside of us. So our behavior is that which is directly related to the heart part of us. Now, what I'd like to say, second of all, is that the heart thinks both good and evil thoughts. There is this conflict inside of us. I think appropriately what Paul describes in the 7th chapter of Romans. There's a part of me that wants to do what God says, but there's a part of me, there's a yearning that's different from that. And so every day I experience in some form or fashion this conflict. Conflict that can be conquered, that can be overcome. And every day that I can win the victory through the help that God gives me. To be different, because I can change the heart and bring it under God's control. But we must all say, as Jesus appropriately said, that our hearts think both good and evil thoughts. Now in this context, in Mark's account of this, Jesus just simply talks about the bad things that come from the heart, because he's talking about what defiles. He's not talking about the good part of the heart. He's explaining in the charge that they've made, the Jews have made against his disciples, that they are defiled because they don't eat, they don't wash their hands when they eat. He's explaining that that doesn't defile the man. And the point is, on the negative side, how does defilement come? It comes from the heart that thinks evil thoughts. He doesn't here deal with the good part and the good thinking part. Let's go back now in our context and observe if that's not the case. Chapter 7 again, and look at verse 15. He says, "There is nothing that enters a man from outside which can defile him, but the things which come out of him, these are the things that defile a man." See, that's is from the evil part that the evil things come, and therefore he's defiled by them. In the same chapter in verse 20, and he said, what comes out of a man defiles him. That assumes that there is evil inside of him, and so what comes out isn't bad because it comes out, but it's bad because it's a product of the evil part. And then in verse 23, all these evil things come from within and defile a man. Now, in the 11th chapter of Luke and verse 39, and then I'm going to pick up another passage in the 9th chapter of Matthew in verse 4, but let's look at Luke's account, chapter 11 and in verse 39. The woes pronounced upon the Pharisees and their hypocrisy. It says, the Lord said, now the Pharisees make the outside of the cup and dish clean, but your inward part is full of greed and wickedness. Now there he's exposing their hypocrisy, and by doing that he's saying, you're so careful about making a good appearance to men. Here's what you're like: whited sepulchres, inside full of dead men's bones. Dishes that are washed on the outside, full of dirty food inside. That's what you're like. And the stress he lays here again is that it's the inner part of you, it's the thinking part of you on the inside, that's full of greed and wickedness. Back in the 9th chapter of Mark, look at verse 4. And again in the context of this chapter, I'm sorry, that's Matthew, the 9th chapter, in verse 4. And this is our context, part of our context that we're studying as well in Luke. Jesus, knowing their thoughts, said, why do you think evil in your hearts? Were they doing that? Yes, that's exactly. This man is guilty of blasphemy. He says, that's evil thinking. Your heart thinks evil. But now let's go over to the 12th chapter of Matthew and look at verse 35, because that at least is some encouragement. Not only does the heart think evil things, but it also thinks good things. Matthew, the 12th chapter, and in verse 35. Go back up to verse 33 as we begin our reading. Either make the tree good and its fruit good, or else make the tree bad and its fruit bad, for a tree is known by its fruit. That's just a simple observation. Brood of vipers, generation of vipers, how can you, being evil, speak good things? For out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. See what he's saying? The mouth cannot say what the heart does not think. It's from the thinking of the heart that the mouth speaks. But then in verse 35, a good man out of the good treasures of his heart brings forth good things. An evil man out of the evil treasure brings forth evil things. There he incorporates both ideas. The heart thinks good and the heart thinks evil. It's for that reason that the wise men a long time ago in Proverbs chapter 4 verse 23 said, keep thy heart with all diligence, for out of it are the issues of life. The idea of keeping is preserving, guarding, watching carefully. That what you think, what you allow to be put in, what you meditate on, keep it. Why? Because it's out of the heart that you find the issues of life. And then in Philippians chapter 4 and verse 8, I think it's that very recognition that caused Paul to talk to the Philippians in reference to the need for thinking. The King James says, literally the idea is meditating, contemplating, savoring, spending time meditating upon it. Finally, brethren, whatever things are true, whatever things are noble, whatever things are just, whatever things are pure, whatever things are lovely, whatever things are of good report, if true, if there is any virtue, and if there is any praiseworthy, meditate on these things. Think, contemplate, spend your time, fill your mind, saturate your heart with these things. Why? Because that's the way you guard your heart. You guard it from the evil influences. You guard it from the evil thoughts that are going to be produced in evil behavior and evil speech. Then again, in Proverbs 23 and verse 7, the wise man said, as a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. As he thinks in his heart, so is he. Now let's go back to the statement I made at the beginning of the lesson. Can a man in reality be what he is not? Can he be what he is not? How many of you ever watched the old Popeye comics? Yeah, raise your hand. I see some smiles. Popeye would say, "I am what I am, and that's what I am." That's what he was. Now, we are what we are. Does that mean that we're pre-programmed and we can't change that? And somebody says, "Well, I am what I am. That's, if my heart is evil, that's the way I am. And I might as well just be that because that's the way I am. I can't change." Doesn't say you can't change. Well, what I've laid out for you in a context is an analysis of Jesus' use of the word heart, and how that God said through the prophet Isaiah, "In vain do you worship me, you honor me with your lips, your heart, inner part, far from me. You present your bodies, your heart is somewhere else." And Jesus says, that's what Isaiah was saying, not just to those people, but he's saying to you as well. Is Isaiah saying that to us? He illustrates how their hearts are evil hearts because they don't really show respect and true praise for God. They are more concerned with their traditions, with their binding of things that are important to them, not what God says, not with respect for His authority. And so when they take one commandment of God, it really shows disrespect for all His commandments and for the person of God Himself. And then he shows, by answering this, to substantiate the charge, how they did it, by taking one commandment of God relating to their parents. Then he draws the people aside and tells them, understand this. It's not what you eat that defiles you, it's what comes out of you. If you hear, you've got ears, you can understand this. Disciples don't understand this. They explain it. So he begins to explain in greater detail. What does it mean? Our problems relate to our hearts. Our faults are those things that cause us to act in a certain way, because our thoughts are what we are inside. So the changing that takes place is not in some way artificially maneuvering or manipulating or controlling our outward behavior. As we say, we've got to get down to the heart of the problem. And our problems relate really directly to our hearts. That's page one. Page two, I'm going to set aside my study of the Old Testament and study page two tonight. Because we're going to demonstrate from Scripture that an evil heart produces evil behavior. A man does not behave in a way that is uncharacteristic of what he thinks. And the second application is that our speech is a direct product of what we think inside of us. We do not accidentally say what we say. But then I think the most important part of this is not to say, boy, we've got a problem. We really got a problem. But to address how God says how you can cure your heart problem. How we can get down to the heart of the matter. What we can do to change the inside part of us. And that's what we've got to address. That's where we have to address the problem. This morning, as we close the lesson, let me tell you that God doesn't want your body without your heart. He doesn't want your praise, your singing, your prayers. He doesn't want your money if the heart is somewhere else. He doesn't want that. Well, are you saying God doesn't want us? No. He doesn't want us to pray? No, He does. He doesn't want us to worship Him? Yes, He does. But I'm telling you that we may well do those things and the heart not be there, and God is offended. God is offended. Because He wants our worship and service to Him to come from the heart. If you're not a Christian, the only way you can become a Christian is from the heart. It won't do any good if you go through some act of saying that you believe in Jesus and being submissive and allowing someone to immerse you in water. Maybe your husband or your wife wants you to, or your parents or somebody else wants you to, and you think, well, it's a good thing to do, I might as well do it. You're not pleasing to God. You know why? Because He wants your heart. And if you don't give Him your heart, all you're doing is just simply going through a form, a ritual. He'll not accept it. And you'll not be in relationship with Him. Paul said, God be thanked that you were the servants of sin, but you obeyed from the heart that form of doctrine. Being then made free from sin, you became the servants of righteousness. Can't do it except as you do it from the heart. And Christian friend and brother, God seeks to control our hearts. And if we go through all these motions and it's a pretense, it's a mere formality, and our hearts, our desires, our emotions, our thoughts are somewhere else, God is offended by that. He is offended. And He would say to us, as Isaiah said 700 B.C. to the Israelites, you honor me with your lips, but your heart is far from me. I don't want it. So if your life is not right, and it's not just a matter of your outward behavior, but conforming that behavior to your heart, get to the heart of the matter and change your heart. Won't you come truly repenting of your sins, asking God's forgiveness? Because God knows our hearts. As we stand to sing, won't you respond if you need to?